Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Martin Moran, who has a memoir, The Tricky Part, One Boy's Fall from Trespass into Grace. Martin Moran is a Broadway performer, has been in several shows, including Titanic, Bells Are Ringing, Cabaret, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, A Man of No Importance, Floyd Collins, working on a theater piece, one-man show of The Tricky Part, which is popping up in various places in San Jose in the fall. The Tricky Part is a memoir about two things, abuse when you were a child, sexual abuse, and coming out as a gay man. What prompted you to start work on this? First of all, was this originally a play rather than the book?
I began working on the book first. I mean, with this material, which I felt was so kind of intimate, and I felt frightened of even sharing it. I worked on it as a book, and then my partner, Henry Stram, one day, well, there were some friends of ours asked if I would do a performance piece at a solo festival a couple years ago, and I said, I don't have a performance piece right now, but I'm just working on this book, and they said, well, would you consider reading an hour and 10 minutes or something from the book? And I thought, well, okay. And that, in its odd, wonderful way, led to the creation of this theater piece, which I then did around the country a bit at Sundance, at Theater Lab, and ran off Broadway last year. Meanwhile, I finished the book. So the play reached the public first, or it reached its fruition first, but I continued to work on the book.
Did you have anybody to work with on the book, any kind of semi-ghost or anything, or is this just yours?
No, it's me. It's my literary debut of sorts. I did have a wonderful editor at Beacon Press. Amy Caldwell is the editor there, and she helped me tremendously.
The title, where did that come from?
I had a really rough time trying to title it. I had all sorts of titles like The Catechism of Sex or Disturbed Regions, and they all were sort of like bum, 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 bum. But actually, ultimately, the title came from going through the text, the book, after it was written, and looking. A friend of mine suggested, look for your title in the book. But the more I worked on the book, the more I realized what I was really trying to write about was the ambiguity and complexity of any human interaction. You know, a death in the family, somebody abusing you, being violated. You know, the first thing you do is look at it in a black and white way. Evildoer, innocent kid. Well, there's a lot of truth to that, but there's a lot in between the spectrum of feelings, the spectrum of reality about that. To me, that's the tricky part, meaning that it's the tricky thing to stay in the ambiguity of being human. Also, very specifically, I think of the tricky part as the tricky part of uncovering the light of God or the grace of God or whatever you want to call it in every human being, including the one that most harmed you.
You were raised Catholic, and that certainly played a role in terms of dealing with your own sexuality. Do you still believe in the Catholic religion?
No. I'm not a practicing Catholic. But I will say this, the church, you know, I don't often go into a church, but the church is absolutely in me. I think it's undeniable when you're raised really Catholic. I mean, like a priest is over for dinner on Sunday nights and your aunts and uncles are Jesuits and Sacred Heart nuns and so on, as is the case in my family. There's a way in which it nearly feels racial being raised Catholic. And this book is, and my play, The Tricky Part, are very much a product of a Catholic person. By that I mean that stuff, that sense of mysticism and ritual and service, I think, was just, you know, I just sucked it in as a kid. And I still feel Catholic, in a way. But I am not a practicing Catholic. So I believe in the Catholic Church insofar as I believe in human beings. When I think of the church as people rather than as this monolithic, patriarchal bunch of white guys hiding their complicity and hiding their crimes and, you know, leading a church full of homophobia. And, you know, then I go down that angry path.
When you were 12 years old, there was a camp counselor. And you went out and you did some work with him, and that night he abused you for the first time. You mentioned two other kids he did, but he was dealing with 30, 40, 50, we don't know how many children. He singled you out. Was that because on some level he might have sensed that you were beginning to come to terms with being gay, or what do you think that was about?
I don't know if it was about my coming to terms with being gay. I was 12, and of course, any notion of being gay was way buried in subconscious.
Right, but a lot of adults see it in kids before the kids see it in themselves.
You know what? I think that's true. And I think probably he preyed on that. I think probably he preyed on also a kid, a little scrawny 12-year-old who was dying for attention, particularly attention from a man. And of course, I had all those nascent feelings of attraction for men. And he was, you know, this big guy who was a mountain camp counselor, and I was, you know, struck by him. He cut a figure, and I wanted his attention. he prayed on that, I'm sure. And also, I must say that, you know, of course, in the book, Bob is a character, and he's based on a real man, and I do, in my experience with him, realize that I knew of two, and then as I've written the book, I've come to know that there were others as well. I think there is such a keen radar for someone who is a perpetrator for an opening, and for someone who won't say, hey, get away, what the hell are you doing? I mean, right. I just didn't have that personality, and I think... And a lot of 12-year-old boys too. You get touched, and it's, you know, it's an amazingly powerful experience when you're, well, at any age, but at that age, you know, particularly.
How are you able to go back and separate out the feelings of want and need from your own adult anger?
The experience of writing it was very much this excavation from the body. The feeling of writing it was very physical, remembering through my body what happened. And digging the memories up. So that what happened was both a deep kind of sadness in remembering it, but also an incredible sense of honoring my own awakening as a boy, as a man, moving into life. That at the same time this guy was committing a crime, he was also a clue as to my identity. The more I was able to, well, to pull apart the threads of all the complexity of what it was, the more I was able to see it in a larger way that allowed my anger to be only one piece of a huge pie rather than a blinding red stuck rage.
You said it took many, many years to write it. Mm-hmm. And I guess when you started writing, you had no idea you'd have a book or a play or anything.
No. It was pure need at the beginning. What happened when you were 12?
How did you attack the original writing? Do you have any idea at this stage how it began?
It existed inside of me as a physical ache. Like there was literally a beast or a thing that wanted out. And thank God, the way it was leaking out, besides my, you know, illicit behavior as a sexual compulsion and so on, but the way the story began to leak out was in words, spread out on a page. And it literally just began to happen accidentally. I was on tour with a musical, Singing in the Rain. I was playing Cosmo. And I was doing the flips off the wall, wanting to live up to good old Donald O'Connor. And I fell, hurt my knee, and wound up in bed for several, you know, like a couple months, with my leg in the air, lying in bed. And as will happen, you know, I was... stopped suddenly after all these busy years in Manhattan. And I was working on text of Shakespeare and studying things, and I kept scribbling things. You know?
It was kind of almost automatic writing.
Yeah, it literally was. And I started describing like a fence on a ranch and all these feelings coming up. And suddenly this sentence popped into my head. I'm about almost 30 years old now, 29, 30 at that time. And this sentence, you know, what happened when you were 12? Tell the truth. Tell the truth. And then these ugly little legal scribbled pages of ink after ink after, I mean, pages and pages and pages and pages, a pure need to make sense of what happened.
In your book, you described that incident, and then you said, I put him in a drawer. And you dropped it for the rest of the book. At what point did you pick it up again?
Some years later, I picked up the pages again. And to tell you the truth, I never really actually studied those pages so much as begin anew. Always beginning anew, my process of writing was, and I'm sure you're familiar with this too, is just a constant rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. I mean, I wished I could have been an Anthony Trollope or someone who woke up and wrote from 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. and then went off to work and never changed a word. But this process of rewriting and rewriting, so I don't remember actually ever picking up the yellow pages again except to glance at them maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years hence. And use them as reference, but by then the way I was constructing sentences were so different than when it first came out that it's almost that the writing is the way that you're opening the portals.
Martin Moran, this is an amazing non-judgmental attitude that leaks in. I mean, we gather our own anger toward Bob and reading it, but the anger is kind of us observing rather than you telling. Did any of your acting training play a role in that?
I think, Richard, your point is well taken, actually. Like when you get a character and you're like playing, quote, the bad guy. If you, the actor, are judging this character, you don't give audience the room to simply say, oh, there's a human being and all his complexity. What I felt most interested in was conveying the story in the most non-judgmental way. The book, hopefully what it does is create a kind of architecture, a space, and you are able to crawl inside and have your own anger, have your own experience as you go through the story.
In 2002, you went back and you saw him. He's still alive now?
I believe so. I'm not sure. I haven't not seen him since that day in 2002.
You kind of indicate, as you walked away from it at the end of the book, that this is kind of an ambivalence. You weren't quite sure. Do you feel greater closure from that or from the book, or can there ever be closure?
It's a big, complicated question. I feel more closure today at this moment talking to you. I feel more closure at the moment because of the book, I think, because it's done and it's an object that exists outside of me, and that's an amazing feeling. Then tomorrow I might feel quite differently. I think that the interesting thing about being human, it's not consistent. It's incredibly fluid. It's this ongoing process. The writing of the book was an amazing experience in transforming an experience that gave me a lot of anguish, agony for years, to transforming it into, I hope, something beautiful, something helpful. That act of transformation has brought me much happiness.
Morton Moran, getting back to the story, now he abused you, and this continued for three years, and included some very peculiar situations involving his girlfriend, until eventually you put a stop to it.
Yes.
At the time, did you see that as an act of courage?
No. I do now, very much so, and I feel great affection for my young self when I think about it. I jumped into a car at 15 years old without a license, and felt I had to confront him. By that time, I pulled away from him anyway, but I felt I had to try and, I think it was at 15 already, trying to find closure and say, I'm ashamed of everything that happened between us. I never want to see you again. You know, that was not right, what happened, essentially, is what I wanted to communicate. At the time, I felt just a complete ball of anguish about it. But as I look back, if you look back on yourself and you think, you know what, you were a strong little kid. And we all have those moments, you know, and we then, in so feeling that, forgive ourselves and say, you know, you're good. You're a good guy. And you did your best. And I feel that kid I was courageous to do that. I did not feel that at the time.
What did you feel?
Like, oh my God, I'm going to see him again, and I promised I never would, but why are you going to see him? Because you're crazy. No, you're going to see him because you're brave. No, you're crazy. You're weak. You're going to see him, and, you know, oh my God, you're just, you know, here you are again, living on the edge and secrecy and shame, and just get back to school, get back to normalcy. Why are you going to see, you know? It was this, like, noise in my head.
During that period, even though you were having sex with a guy, it did not help at all dealing with being gay as a kid.
Exactly. I think because, I guess in the best of all possible worlds, we would all go step by step finding an authentic sense of self, of desire, of our erotic being, of our spiritual being. And I think society wants that for us. Our families want for us to step as gingerly or as gently as possible into finding out who we are. And that's our hope for our children, I think. When something this violent happens, and it is a violent thing, I think one of the deepest crimes is that the road toward authenticity is just ripped away. And what you are is in panic mode, in survival mode. In my case, I had this nascent sense of being a gay boy, I think, somewhere subconsciously. And part of the terror and horror and crime for me, one aspect of it, was that I spent many years, my teens, my early 20s, feeling that maybe I'm not gay, maybe he made me that way. Maybe what happened screwed me up, that my wiring got screwed up. And I would go to and talk to a therapist here and there, and I felt suicidal and completely depressed and wanted to kill myself a couple times, and I don't say that lightly. It's a huge thing to want to leave the planet, you know, in that way. But it just made what's already a difficult thing to feel okay about being gay more difficult. It was abuse.
You're listening to an interview with Martin Moran, whose memoir is titled The Tricky Part. You gloss over that period where you actually did come out. The actual coming out process, was there any relationship there when you were dealing with it, or do you, by that point, compartmentalize Bob into this little corner of your brain so you were able to go, okay, I'm gay, or did this thing, that feeling that maybe you weren't gay, that you'd been forced into it, how did that all work? Have you gotten a grip on it now?
I think now, at the ripe age of 45, I've gotten a lot more grip on it, but in the early years, I really didn't. It continued to be confusing, and I continued to try and struggle against my feelings of being attracted to other men. I do describe a small event in the book of being sort of head over heels for a few minutes with an upperclassman at Stanford University, where I was an undergraduate. And walking the next morning, nothing happened between us except that we held one another, and it was so intense, my desire for it to go further, that I'm walking down Palm Drive there, whatever it is, back to school, and and think, and I just really just said to myself, listen, wake up. This is what you want. You're gay. Even then, I tried to push it back down. But actually, it was then, a couple of years later, living here in San Francisco, I went to ACT, the conservatory here, which was a wonderful school. And that's where I really experienced my first love, with a wonderful boy named Bill, who was somehow more evolved than I about all of this, and just looked me in the eye, and he loved me.
Was that one of the things that prompted you to say, to hell with it, I am worth it, and I want to be an actor?
Yes, they were intertwined, very much so. The desire to be an actor felt very linked with my sexuality, oddly enough, and I tried to get to that in the book, but I couldn't quite, that felt like it could be a whole thing unto itself, how my authentic sense of self and sexuality and desire felt part and parcel with this desire to get on stage and sing and tell stories and be, you know, shake my hips and put on makeup, you know, that they were intertwined somehow. And interestingly enough, you know, I wrenched my way away from Stanford. I was miserable at Stanford, just miserable. And I left after those first couple of years and said goodbye to the whole shebang. And so an audition for acting schools and went to ACT, and that was also when, I mean, you're around actors in a theater program, and suddenly it's like permission for authentic human expression is all over the map. And, you know, it's like anything goes, and it's thank God.
When you went to New York, here you were going to New York. You had coming out of a situation where you did not have a high sense of self, and yet you managed at the same time to get quite a few roles. How did that work?
I don't know exactly. I feel very lucky. I always had a lot of anxiety about everything, and anxiety is an interesting thing because it can be, I sort of sometimes change the word anxiety to fuel because it's like this engine. And I had so much anxiety when I moved to New York. The way it manifested itself was just sheer unadulterated discipline. Ballet class, voice class, waiting tables at Joe Allen's restaurant, get the cash, do the thing, go to the audition, look it up, go up the stairs, try to sing, you stand up, do it again. I had a lot of perseverance, a lot of discipline, and I had wonderful friends who actually all lived here in San Francisco, and we moved nearly at the same time to New York, and we got a big loft together in Soho, and we supported one another, kept each other sane in those early years.
What was your first show?
My first real professional show ever in New York was the revival of Oliver in 1984, I think it was, and Patti LuPone, Ron Moody. It was a huge flop. It opened and closed within like 3 weeks, but I was blind to all of that. I was just in sheer heaven that I'd gotten a job.
Well, what was your role? Were you just one of the chorus boys?
I was one of the, you know, I was the pie man and the, you know, and the pies, get your pies here. And also I understudied Noah Claypool and got to do it a few times, which was the guy who's at the funeral home, you know, open up the door, you little workhouse brat, that guy. Yeah, that was my equity car, and it was my beginning.
You were also in Bells Are Ringing. Was that the Faith Prince flop?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, we didn't do well, but bless Faith. You know, she's doing great. She's on Huff now and a regular on that series, and I just saw her the other night. I had a wonderful time in that because I had a fantastic part.
Which was?
Dr. Kitchell, the dentist. I had a wonderful time creating that character, and I had great success with it.
And you were in the revival of Cabaret?
Yes, playing Ernst Ludwig. I don't know if you know the actor Dennis O'Hare, the part Dennis played, Ernst Ludwig, the amiable Nazi, is how we described him. He's the friendly guy who befriends Cliff, and his sexuality is ambiguous, but at the end of the first act, it's revealed that he's a member of the Nazi party, and he sings Tomorrow Belongs to Me, and that guy.
Who were you playing opposite at that point? Was that the original cast of it, or...?
Some of the original, but when I came in, Susan Egan was Sally Bowles, and Michael Hall, who's now in 6 Feet Under the Sun, it was the MC, and Michael Hayden, a wonderful actor, was playing Cliff. I stayed with it for a while and went, you know, Susan Egan, Leah Thompson, Jolie Fisher, many Sally Bowles.
And you were also in The Man of No Importance, mm-hmm. and you got to know Terrence McNally at
yeah,
that point.
Very well, and he wrote so beautifully about my book. He's a wonderful supporter, my work and other people's work, and he's a lovely guy, great writer.
I interviewed him for A Man of No Importance when it was out here. Wonderful show.
A beautiful show. I had a wonderful time doing it.
And you played?
Ernie Lally. I played one of the silly Irish guy, folks who was, silly I say, just one of those adorable characters who's part of a theater community, the part of the church.
You were also in the revival of How to Succeed with Matthew Broderick, and you played, I guess, one of the office guys.
Mr. Tackerberry, and I also went on quite a bit for Matthew.
And one other show, which not many people know about, is Adam Goodell's first show, Floyd Collins.
Yes, yes.
And what were you in that? Just a reporter?
Or? No, I played, well, I played Skeet Smiller, a reporter, but he was sort of the main reporter. His story is really, it's an amazing story. He was a true figure from the Louisville Courier-Journal who scooted down this hole and tried to rescue Floyd Collins and carried on these interviews while hanging over Floyd Collins. I originated that part and had an incredible experience. And Adam Goodell's Light in the Piazza is the absolute most beautiful thing going on in New York City right now. It's an extraordinary play, musical.
So you've been in all of these shows. Let me ask you about age discrimination. As you move into your 40s, what do you see? I mean, is it getting harder for you or not in that way?
In some ways. I'm in a place where it's a very particular situation because I'm a guy who wrote a book and I'm zipping around dealing with the book and my own one-man play. And since I'm so focused on the tricky part right now, in some ways I've pulled myself out of the immediate arena of Broadway shows or, you know, upcoming musicals and plays. But in general, I would say for a guy, for me, I think two things happen. You get more discerning about what you want to do, so there's many less things you're interested in doing. But I find the parts getting more interesting, more complex, more adult, which is nice, because I've always kind of been the boy-faced young guy. But I think the opportunities for me are still there. The folks I feel have the most difficult time are the ladies at my age. You're either a super star, a super TV star, or you're 18 and gorgeous. I think it can be harder for ladies. There's just simply a lot more parts for men.
There also seems to be fewer and fewer people who are just Broadway stars these days.
Yeah.
And that's kind of sad.
It is very sad because you can't sustain a life. But one is forced to find other ways to have an income, both because the shows are fewer, the stakes are higher, the cost is higher, and to sustain, to go from show to show, the shows just aren't there. They're more of these mega spectacle. They're not based on artists so much as concept in some ways.
Well, Martin Moran, as you get past this, are you going to do more writing, or are you going to get back into theater, or what?
Well, I think I'll always act and do theater, and I hope to do more TV and film as an actor as I go on. But this, definitely my life has shifted more into being an author, I think, and a writer. This book has been a tremendous experience, and I hope the book does well. The MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey has commissioned me to write a one-act play, which will be performed this October. So I'm continuing to write and want to write, and I'd love to find a way to make that be a little more remunerative and sustain an artistic life. But I believe I'll always act, and I hope to do both. There's some kind of shift going on.
When you're working on converting a story into a play and vice versa, how did you find that process of taking what was written into the play and then later on taking what was in the play and putting it back in the book?
It was a really fascinating process. In a very technical way, one of the things that happened was it simply was a visceral experience of how the language shifts slightly. The language is more colloquial in the play, but the play is very etched language because it had been written in a book. Many of the discoveries I made while doing the play, both emotionally and spiritually and by talking with audience members, many of those visceral experiences of performing, found those ideas that came up, found their way back into the book. But the essential difference was that the play was a lot more economic and a lot more about the telling omission, like what is left out, and the play was a lot more colloquial. And the play is about the experience of being in the room with the author, I think, to see, okay, this guy's okay, and he went through this, and that's part of the experience. The book, then, it began to be, again, this physical feeling of how to create the sense of going through an experience just with the written word. They're two different beasts. But it was very tricky along the way to understand that both forms were different. The director, Seth Barish, a wonderful director from New York who directed the play, was enormously helpful because he had a great ear for the spoken word as opposed to the written word. He would have me improvise a lot and then, by improvising, shift some of the very written language. And I think when you perform it, you have an immediate sense of what's ringing true and what isn't. And it's an amazing experience, to walk the story, to walk through it with people. And I hope that that helped make the book more vivid.
Martin Moran, your Catholic upbringing did give you a sense of a greater power in terms of forgiveness and in terms of the word grace, let's say, which seems to be fairly important. The difficulty comes for somebody who does not have that belief system. How do you achieve some kind of grace if you don't believe in religion?
I think there's a distinction between religion and a basic instinctual sense of a larger orchestration of this deeply mysterious universe. Grace, sometimes I think, is just another word for consciousness. That there are these moments, you know, have you ever had them, I'm sure, in your life, where you go, oh, aha. There's a kind of heightened awareness, an awareness of how profound and mysterious it is to be in this body, to be on this planet. Grace to me is sort of like a moment of light or consciousness when you are given the gift of a breath, of feeling a sense of faith that really it is all in some kind of order, even with all the violation and the harm and the ache and the pain, that there is this journey we're on that is graced somehow with this incredible thing of being alive. I think that I would say to someone who has no religion that folks have a sort of organic or instinctual, I think we do as human beings, an instinctual desire to be awakened, to move toward consciousness. That, to me, is the movement of grace.
In writing this book and in knowing it was going to get published, you also knew that two groups of people would read it, those who were abused and also possibly gay kids dealing with coming out. After all this time, and even despite the gay rights movement, do you think that there's any way to ease the process of coming out for, say, a 15 or a 16-year-old?
Yeah.
Maybe it's harder in Colorado Springs than in Berkeley
or
in San Francisco, but maybe it's not.
You know, it's all so much, it seems, about cultural context. And you mentioning Colorado Springs versus Berkeley, you know, Colorado Springs, which is, you know, Christian family, whatever, central, you know, I think the messages you get are so loud and clear that we're still getting those messages, certainly from the Catholic Church, certainly from this administration in one way or another, that these desires are somehow not good. The only thing that comes to mind is how do you ease that process is that we all speak to one another about the sanctity and wonder and of having desire and having a body, and that one's desires are precious and wonderful and not evil or wrong or misdirected. That message we must continue to put out there and look a 15-year-old in the eye who says, you know, I have a friend who's got a 15-year-old son who's very out. He's in Los Angeles, and I'm amazed. He just went around the state of California giving a speech about gay marriage, the rights, and he's a 15, 16-year-old kid, young man. I was stunned that this is happening. I mean, I felt it gave me great hope that there's a lot more of this openness. You know, this sense that we're in a time again when we have an administration where there's black and white and where there's you're either with us or you're against us. That, to me, is just so dangerous and fascist. And the more that we can speak about the celebration of one's authentic being, one's authentic voice as being primary, as I think Jesus believed in Buddhist and Buddha and Mohammed and at their core, that those deepest things which are within you, if you get them out, will save you. If you keep them in, will kill you.
Do you see a role for the artist there? I would guess you definitely do.
Always, I think. I think when we speak most authentically with a personal voice, we shorten the distance between ourselves. It might be uncomfortable. I know this book is uncomfortable to people. It's pushing a lot of different buttons. When we speak to one another authentically, it's when we most learn what's most deeply universal about being human.
Martin Moran, how has your family responded to the book?
In many different ways. My siblings are 100% supportive and admiring. I have a sister who's a visual artist, and she's very, you know, she always likens like this is a painting, and she sees it very much in terms of it's an object of art that's been worked on and crafted, and there's a lot of support from all of them. It's been trickiest for my parents because with the story, for them, comes an automatic sense of culpability. They're deeply kind, deeply good people who were in the middle of the 70s doing Catholic PTA and going off to work and trying to hold themselves together. Dad, bit of a drinker. Mom, struggling with her own personal problems, and we were fending for ourselves emotionally.
But there's a line in there where your mother said, I'd rather have a son, I think, who's dead than homosexual. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you put that in there.
I did. And that's hard for her to read. It's not hard, ultimately, in the sense that she sees that I'm honoring my memories, and also the book does relay that this incredible woman and my mom and me are still our dear, dear friends and have journeyed through all of this together, and that she, like me, traveled from point A to point Z. She loves my boyfriend Henry and celebrates me. It's been harder and trickier for my father, all of that. He's a much more conservative guy. Look, telling a tale this true and this raw is tough on them, I think, my parents. and they're negotiating it as best they can, and they're I think they're proud of me in a certain way.
Martin Moran, where do you see Broadway going?
I don't know. It's, you know, it's like many things in life when you think of Starbucks and Barnes & Noble, God bless them because they're supporting my book, and Gap and, you know, larger and larger corporate kind of energy of how things work in a modern capitalistic society, this engine that just goes. I'm sad to say that you see that engine have its effect on the sort of mega Broadway musical gestalt that's out there. So by that I mean that you have these enormous shows that are very pastiche and reviewy and big and escapist and hugely expensive, and it's either hit or miss. I'm sure you've talked about this before. It's either you have to have a huge hit or there's in there or you're a flop, and there's nothing in between. So it leaves very little room for the very tender and very difficult process of creating new work. That being said, you do have voices, as you've mentioned, Terrence McNally, Stephen Flaherty, and Lynn Ahrens. You've got right now on Broadway Light in the Piazza, which is a gorgeous piece of work. It took a lot of nurturing in Seattle and Chicago prior to coming to New York, but it's there, and it's making its presence known, and it's an intelligent, warm, human, complex story. That gives me hope that the art form has viability, the art form of Broadway. It's difficult when commerce becomes so intertwined with art, and Broadway is, and I think it always has been, you know, it's a huge amount about commerce, but that's also an incredible kind of fuel. Look, always at its core, there are storytellers and writers and musicians and composers born who have to tell something and have to tell a story, and they'll find a nook and cranny downtown. They'll find a little hall. They'll find a way to say it. And if it speaks to human beings, it will also find its way. So in that way, Broadway will always live.
Martin Moran, your one-man play will play in San Jose when?
At San Jose Repertory Theater, opening October, starting previews October 13th, running till mid-November at that beautiful theater in San Jose. And, so I'm really looking forward to being in the Bay Area for a whole month.
And you've been listening to an interview with Martin Moran, whose book is titled The Tricky Part, One Boy's Fall from Trespass into Grace. Is that your subtitle?
Yes, it is.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.